Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to this edition of the Soapbox. Today, I'll be speaking to Whitney Webb. Whitney is a staff writer for The Last American Vagabond. She has previously written for Mint Press News, Ben Swan's Truth in Media. Her work has appeared on Global Research, the Ron Paul Institute, and 21st Century Wire, among others. She currently lives with her family in southern Chile. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Whitney. Whitney Webb, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Hey, Cindy. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you again. Just briefly tell my listeners a little bit about yourself.
All right, so I worked for a little over 3 years at Mint Press News. I recently left and am working at The Last American Vagabond, where I'm pretty much doing a lot of the same stuff, writing articles, doing a little more video stuff than I've been used to. But that's fine with me. And I'm also about to start a book on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. I did an investigative series on that case last year.
Right.
And it's going to be a book here. I have to turn it in by the end of June, so it should be out sometime in the fall. So, yeah, I've been pretty busy.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let me know, and then we can have you back on again, or if you want me to blurb it or review
it.
Oh,
wonderful.
But we
sure.
definitely will help you promote it. So the reason I asked you to be on the show this week is, first of all, since we are on lockdown, I can't really do much besides my podcast, which... Yeah, I was used to doing one a week. Now I'm trying to do just whenever I can get a guest and just get it posted. But I've been long interested in Venezuela. I've been down there several times. Hugo Chavez was a friend of mine. I like admire him greatly. I admire what he did for Venezuela greatly. But I've also been very aware of the U.S. interference in Venezuela, that really intensified after Hugo Chavez took office in 1998, but now it just seems to be ramping up to a hysterical level. But you wrote an article called As U.S. Shale Oil Plunges, the Trump Admin Takes Aim at Venezuela. And so I want to just start with your conclusion, which it was pretty alarming, that a confluence of factors suggests that a Panama-style invasion of Venezuela is not only a possibility, but increasingly likely. And just take it from there. So just talk about that.
Right. So I've come to that conclusion just based on things that have happened recently since the whole coronavirus crisis has emerged. And one of my reasons for saying that, we can go into more detail on each of these points if you want later, mm-hmm. is that first and foremost, as I'm sure people are aware, there has been just total chaos in oil markets, mm-hmm. specifically with the price of oil. Of course, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, it's not just oil supplies, but also the petrodollar system mm-hmm. that keeps the U.S. Very interested in what happens in oil markets and has them very interested in trying to maintain control over the flow of hydrocarbons and oil throughout the world, as well as control over key oil suppliers in the world. And we've seen, you know, in the past, several wars for oil or CIA coups for oil. So that type of history, you know, should be well known to most people. But what's alarming now is Trump several times, and, you know, there's reason to doubt this, but at least publicly he says things like, you know, we're not in the Middle East for oil anymore because we're energy independent. And his claims of energy independence have to do with the U.S. Fracking industry, fracking for oil or shale oil industry. And because the oil markets have been rocked so substantially by what has happened with coronavirus, basically that entire sector is facing bankruptcy, except for maybe just a very small handful of companies. And it's actually even the Federal Reserve of the United States is now expecting that in just a few months, we'll see around half of all domestic oil fracking companies in the U.S. go belly up, go completely bankrupt, which, of course, then means that the U.S. will not be producing its own oil. It has to go look for oil elsewhere. And we all know that Trump is also, for his administration and the neocons and all of this, have also been interested in a war with Iran. But the reason they haven't done that is because of the chaos that could potentially create in oil markets because of a potential blockade on the Strait of Hormuz or something like that.
Right.
And the U.S. military has always been really interested in maintaining a close supply of oil geographically close to the United States, not all just in the Middle East because of the instability that's largely U.S. created that happens there. So now that this domestic source within the U.S., you know, borders of oil is, you know, set to go belly up, you know, that has appears to have been a major factor behind this surprising renewed interest that we've seen as this coronavirus pandemic crisis has played out of the Trump administration in Venezuelan regime change. Because as this whole, you know, pandemic and the crisis and all of this has been unfolding, instead of, you know, doing, there was a series of odd pivots, including a press conference on April 1st of the Trump administration suddenly talking about Venezuela again under the guise of coronavirus, saying, for example, they indicted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro on what they said were narco-trafficking charges. Okay. Then they make this claim on April 1st that they have to make these massive deployments of military assets and naval ships right off of Venezuelan territorial waters, saying that they have to prevent narco-trafficking during the time of pandemic, that narco-traffickers in Venezuela want to take advantage of the pandemic to flood the U.S. with drugs. Of course, this is just an absurd case on its face, because anyone that actually knows what goes on with the drug trade in Latin America knows that Colombia is the number one producer of cocaine and, you know, the country where most of the narco trafficking takes place, and that it does so with the complicity of the Colombian army and intelligence in the United States. And it's just, you know, I mean, I would refer people to works like Dark Alliance by Gary Webb and other things that have pointed out those ties. So this is obviously, this buildup obviously has a very ulterior motive. I argue in my piece that it's related to the shale industry, but it's not just this deployment that concerns me. It's also the fact that we have Attorney General William Barr, who was the Attorney General during the administration of George H.W. Bush, who greenlighted the invasion of Panama with a very controversial legal justification for that war. He is in that same position now. And we're also seeing someone who's also basically a repeat of that same era, Elliot Abrams, who was very involved in a lot of these dirty wars and the backing of right-wing death squads in Latin America in the 1980s, is now back as the U.S. Special Envoy for Venezuela. And his recent statements, I don't know if you saw them, Cindy, but they were honestly very disturbing. He was essentially saying that if Maduro does not agree to this recent plan that Pompeo put out at the end of March, I believe, that calls for this transition government, that the transition in Venezuelan governance or, you know, regime change, it would still happen. But according to Abrams, it would be, quote, dangerous and abrupt.
Right.
So Abrams essentially saying, you know, making a threat of invasion, and combined with all these other factors I'm pointing out, it looks increasingly alarming. And another reason I think we should be concerned is because of the lockdown and the quarantines and all of this in the U.S., it would be very difficult to mount any sort of protest or anti-war resistance to such an invasion, given the current circumstances that have, you know, arisen because of the coronavirus crisis. Mm-hmm. And frequently governments, including governments with, you know, neocons in them, often exploit crises for their own agendas, whether that's what happened after the wake of September 11th, or whether it's happening, you know, under the guise of the current crisis. They frequently try and implement long-term agendas by taking advantage of chaos and fear.
Right. I mean, Rahm Emanuel famously said, never let a good crisis go to waste. And the Trump administration, from robbing, you know, reverse Robin Hood, taking from the poor and giving to the rich in this crisis, and his exploitation of the crisis to do things like what's happening in Venezuela, are just, you know, just shows that's what the neocons, like you said, or neoliberals, that's their main goal, is to maybe the crises like 9/11, no matter what we think about it, if we think that the Bush administration did it, or if we believe the official story, whatever happened, they really have exploited that greatly. And so they put the United States in a state of terror. And then they, when things like the coronavirus happen, it's easier to get us to comply with their, you know, treachery.
Right. That's definitely true. And I think that's also true, going off topic a little bit, about some of the solutions they're trying to implement now under coronavirus, like expanded surveillance of people, mm-hmm. William Barr asking for indefinite detention. We saw these things sort of, you know, in a way be implemented after 9/11 through things like the Patriot Act. And of course, the Patriot Act was supposed to keep us safe.
Right.
It did not. And now the U.S. openly supports al-Qaeda in Syria and Yemen. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to believe that these type of solutions are here to protect us. But history shows that it clearly has an ulterior motive, and it's not about what we're told it's about at the time. And that these, you know, forces often take advantage of situations like what's going on with coronavirus to do these things. But what is alarming also is that, you know, as was the case with the 9/11, it wasn't just civil liberties in the U.S. that were eroded, but also we were taken to war based on lies. And it's very possible that there could be some sort of repeat of that as well, potentially with Venezuela, which I think is very disconcerting. But there are a lot of similarities, as I point out in my article, to what preceded the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989 and what's going on now. One of the major ones, besides William Barr being in the same position,
right.
The other one is that the size of this military deployment that was announced April 1st is the largest U.S. military buildup in that area since the invasion of Panama. So it's definitely not a joke, that deployment. And given the militarism of some people in the U.S. government with respect to Venezuelan regime change, whether it's someone like Elliot Abrams or someone like Marco Rubio, I mean, there has been talk for years, even by Trump himself, by people close to the administration or in the administration, of a military invasion of Venezuela. Trump, of course, has this mentality of let's just take the oil, mm-hmm. And things of this nature. I think it's not perhaps naive of them to assume they won't encounter much resistance in Venezuela, because there is a lot of popular support
right.
for the government there. And even people that may not like Maduro that much, I think they are definitely, there's going to be a lot of resistance against the U.S. imposing a type of government,
right.
The government of their choice on Venezuela. At the very least, most Venezuelans appear to, you know, want sovereignty. And Juan Guaido, even though this new transition plan they put out in recent weeks calls for him to step down, in the past, he was, his party was essentially saying that if Guaido were to take power, that the U.S. government would be part of his administration, making it essentially Venezuela, essentially a colony of the United States, which I think, you know, is obviously going to be something that would alarm people in Venezuela. But what's another disturbing parallel, though, between Panama and what's going on now is painting the leader of the country as a narco trafficker. In the case of
right.
Panama, this was true.
Right.
Manuel Noriega was drug trafficking, and he was a dictator, but his dictatorship was backed by the United States. He was involved in drug running with the CIA, including
right.
Playing a supporting role in Iran-Contra.
Right.
But there was a point where he had outlived his usefulness. But of course, you know, he was all this information was put out there. Noriega is a drug trafficker. He's a dictator. There's no human rights. There's no democracy in Panama. We're seeing those same lines come out about Venezuela right now. And even though it was true with Noriega, what they didn't mention is that it was the U.S. that had basically overseen that situation in Panama and supported it. And it ended up outliving its usefulness because of what was happening with the Panamanian government about to take control away from the U.S. of the Panama Canal, which, of course, the invasion prevented from taking place. So what we do know is that the justification for taking out Noriega was not what the war was really about. And, of course, anyone that knows that Venezuela sits on the world's largest oil reserves knows that the motives behind regime change in Venezuela are not about democracy and human rights. The governments that preceded Hugo Chavez were very brutal and hardly democratic, and there were several dictators in Venezuela in that period of time, and that did not bother the U.S. because they had economic arrangements regarding debt and oil that were very beneficial to the U.S. economic system. So obviously they turned a blind eye to those sorts of things. But we're seeing a lot of the same narratives being put forth, a lot of the same deployments. And, you know, in the case of what Elliot Abrams said recently, you know, direct threats to do just that. And there is, again, the very real concern that someone like William Barr, who is attorney general right now, will make the same legal justification he made for the invasion of Panama, which is that the U.S. had legal authority to go to Panama, a different country, and arrest Noriega there on drug charges that Maduro is now facing.
Right.
So it's definitely a dangerous situation that has been created and is largely being motivated, in my opinion, by the collapse of the U.S. shale industry, and also the fact that Venezuela in the next couple of months is set to start up new joint venture oil initiatives, one with a Russian oil company and another one with European oil companies. They have explicitly stated they don't want those to go forward, and those projects are going to begin. One begins in May and one begins in June. And another thing that I found to be a red flag is that they, Chevron, the only U.S. oil company still doing business in Venezuela, was basically told this week to wrap it up and to get out of Venezuela pretty much as soon as possible. In January, they had the Trump administration had given Chevron a waiver to stay until April 22nd. And now that that date has passed, the Trump administration came out and said, we're not renewing it again. You need to get out now. That is definitely, all of these things, if you take them together, it just it looks really dangerous. And given the fact that, you know, anti-war resistance because of the lockdown would be difficult to mobilize, it adds another layer of concern for me anyway.
Right. Definitely. So you were talking about the administrations before Chavez being, you know, pro-U.S., pro-U.S. oil companies, etc., but they had terrible human rights violations. And then you mentioned that Colombia, you know, they are actually in the area, they're the ones that are doing the drug trafficking and also have terrible human rights.
Yes.
And they're like, I think it's the most dangerous place to be a union organizer in the world. And
it's one of them.
But very good friends with the United States. So the United States obviously doesn't care about, I mean, the CIA is like a big drug trafficking company. They reinstated the opium trade in Afghanistan after the invasion. So, you know, to have this as a basis for an invasion of Venezuela is obviously just like, you know, trumped up. And that's amazing that his name is Trump and that these charges are trumped up. And the opposition, I think there would be a very big anti-war response to this. We had the last big rally that we had in Washington, D.C. that wasn't, you know, part of March on the Pentagon was in support of Venezuela a couple years ago. So I just think that a lot of times our government doesn't listen. This government doesn't listen to us anyway.
Unfortunately, that's been true for the past several years, too. Whether it was protests about Occupy Wall Street or protests against, you know, different wars or attempted wars or attempted regime change operations in recent years. They, you know, generally try and, ignore any sort of manifestations that try and oppose that. And, of course, complicit in that cover up of these protests and all of that would be the mainstream media, who oftentimes does not report on these types of protests and tries to sort of omit them and keep them out of the public sphere, so to speak. But I think something that's really important now is to really share this type of information, around as much as possible, and point out that the last thing we need right now with this current crisis is a war on top of everything else. Mm-hmm. And I think especially one that's not necessary and like is just so transparently not about human rights and democracy or narco trafficking, as you pointed out and I mentioned earlier. This is all about oil and the petrodollar, and how oil, the historic collapse in oil prices, which went to like below zero recently, which is just, just totally unprecedented and insane, how that directly threatens the entire petrodollar system, which supports the entire U.S. global military empire on top of it, right? I mean, this type of situation in oil markets creates an unprecedented crisis for those power structures that we don't necessarily see on the surface, but we know are there. We know greatly influence U.S. foreign policy, specifically what it does, what the U.S. military does, right? And so, it's not, if it was just like the military deployment and some of these threats, coming out of officials, I wouldn't be as concerned as I am by the fact that we're seeing this go on in oil markets right now. In the U.S., if you read, the Pentagon, defense strategies and all of this, they are acutely concerned and determined to hold on to the U.S.'s global military hegemony or economic hegemony or just hegemony in general, really. Mm-hmm. And anything that undermines the petrodollar system is a direct threat to that, right?
Well, can you talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia's role in the collapse of the oil prices?
Right. So part of it has to do with the fact that essentially OPEC has really been overshadowed for the past several years by Russia and Saudi Arabia directly having these, oil price wars, essentially, in terms of production cuts, who's going to commit to production cuts. This was all actually a policy, if you look at where it came from, that was orchestrated by the United States having the Saudis do this. And the goal was to try and target Russia's economy, which by sanctioning their oil producers and all of this, and then, lowering the oil price well below where it was before. And this has just backfired spectacularly for the U.S. because it didn't actually have the intended effect on the Russian economy. And it, obviously undermined the Saudi Arabia's, their income from oil, because they have to sell at lower prices and all of this. But essentially, it's just a continuation of this, production cut war, I guess you could say, between, that's really been dominated and decided by Russia and Saudi Arabia, with the U.S. backing Saudi Arabia. And now it's just leading to just total, it just led to really total chaos in the markets. And it's just, like I said, it has totally backfired. And now the U.S. is looking for these other potentially very dangerous solutions to try and resolve the chaos it helped create in oil markets.
Right. So, I've met Nicolas Maduro. He's an amazing person. He really has struggled to hold Venezuela together after the death of Hugo Chavez. But when I heard him being accused of being a narco trafficker, my heart sunk, because that's a code word, I think, to me. That's like, I wonder how he felt about it when he was accused of that. I know he's very strong, and I know he fights back and challenges all of these things, but it's just a really harbinger of all kinds of evil to hear that narco trafficker accusation.
Right, because it's like a narco-terrorism, mm-hmm. Accusation. I mean, the road between that, the lines between those two charges is very, very thin, in all honesty. And I think, because of the wide net that the U.S. cast with its war on terror, mm-hmm. the U.S. feels that it has authority to go to other countries and overthrow governments if there is a, threat of quote-unquote terrorism. At least, they put out that as the justification in public, right? I think a lot of people in the U.S. even now would be, considering everything that's going on, would see through the fact, whatever justification is given for a potential war with Venezuela, if it's not specifically mentioning oil, you know, if they're going to go with this narco trafficking business, I think most people will know that doesn't make a lot of sense because the U.S. government has done very little to combat the opioid crisis.
Right.
And I think a lot of Americans know that, you know, most of the cocaine sold in the U.S. isn't coming from Venezuela, you know, at this point anyway. And I think, you know, there may be a lot of resistance, at least in terms of the American public buying that excuse. But it seems like they just don't really care. They're just going to run with it anyway. And they think they can get away with it, probably because of the lack of accountability for the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, attempted regime change in Syria. I mean, the list really goes on.
Libya, they got away with it before. So that's why they think they can get away with it again.
Right. So I it seems like they're putting even less effort than they did, you know, after 9/11 in trying to lie us in the war with Iraq. It seems like they're putting even less effort into all that now. It's just, you know, they're just doing it for show, I guess, because they can't come out and say we want the oil, though. I mean, Trump, to an extent, has done that and has helped, I think, in some ways to sort of take the mask off of empire and show what really motivates it for people that couldn't see that before. But, you know, it's still the same old motives driving policy, and they have become increasingly less, you know, interested in any sort of resistance in the U.S. But I think they're also underestimating people right now. And that there is a lot of, you know, backlash growing about the erosion of civil liberties, you know, through some of the policies being promoted, you know, during the current crisis. And if there's a push for war with Venezuela, I think there will be a huge pushback about that. But, you know, we'll see if that actually ends up factoring into their plans. Or, you know, there's also the unfortunate historical precedent of, you know, false flag terrorism being used to get the U.S. embroiled in a war. The most famous example probably being the Gulf of Tonkin incident that led to, you know, U.S. involvement. Well, the U.S. was in Vietnam before, but, you know, open U.S. involvement in Vietnam in the Gulf of Tonkin didn't even happen, right? So it's possible we could try and they might try and do something like that here, but I really hope that's not the case.
And it's an election year, and trust me, that factors there. All their decisions, that factors into that. And then, so we have Biden, who, you know, he was a member of an administration that escalated wars in the Middle East that was very hostile to Venezuela, called Venezuela, Venezuela, like, you know, one of the major
Sponsor of terrorism.
One of the global sponsors of terrorism. So there's no, like, electorally, politically, there's no solution because both parties are, you know, are like, they're very warlike and they've been very hostile to Venezuela. So we just have to do what we can and keep us posted about any thing you want us to know, you want us to expose, or, you know, spread any information you want us to get out there. And we'll keep posted. I know I'll keep posted closely about this issue because, you know, it's very, very important to me. Venezuela, I think, has really been heroic in trying to stick to its own sovereignty. You know, hey, what what a concept. You mean we get to vote for our own leaders? It's like, really? And, you know, like, how can the U.S. say they're going to impose a leader when they tried to impose a leader who was completely rejected by the people of Venezuela? I mean, it's not going to work out for them. It didn't work out for them then. It's not going to work out for them. And it's and if the U.S. does decide to invade, it won't be easy because the people of Venezuela will fight back, and they do have a military that is loyal mostly to the current administration in Venezuela.
Right, because, you know, U.S. has been trying, especially ever since they, like, appointed Juan Guaido, basically, to be, like, the quote-unquote interim president of Venezuela. There have been numerous attempts that have been U.S.-backed to try and get the military to turn on Maduro, and they have not.
Right.
So to think that, you know, that would suddenly change now after everything that's happened at this point just honestly seems really unlikely, I think. Like you said, the military is going to stand its ground in Venezuela and is going to resist U.S. invasion. There's already been claims from people in the Venezuelan military that if the U.S. invades, that they will be you know, the new Vietnam, mm-hmm. and, you know, essentially do that type of warfare
right.
against the U.S. Of course, the U.S. had to end up leaving Vietnam, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, that's what they're saying. And I think the U.S., you know, there may be people in the U.S., you know, population that may not realize, may not remember what happened in Vietnam. You know, I wasn't alive then, but I've read about it and I've learned about it. But, you know, those have impacts that are not just, they don't just stay in that foreign country where the fighting is taking place. I mean, this can have really global repercussions and definitely repercussions in the U.S., especially with everything going on in the world right now. So this is definitely something that we should follow closely, and we should definitely resist any other, you know, any efforts for the U.S. to try and enact, you know, illegal regime change, and whether it's in Venezuela or Syria or any other country. This is something that people just need to consistently oppose.
Well, Whitney, thank you so much for being on the Soapbox this week. It was really an amazing conversation. What is the website that you're publishing on now called?
So I'm publishing at thelastamericanvagabond.com. It's mm-hmm. also a YouTube channel. Sometimes I go on the YouTube show and I talk about my articles, or I share some interviews and things like that I've done there. So you can follow my work on that website. You can also follow me on Twitter at _WhitneyWeb. I'm also on Mastodon as Whitney Webb, in case I get booted off Twitter, which might be possible, given everything that's going
probable.
On right now.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, so I never heard of my Mastodon. That's the first, actually, I've heard of Mastodon at all. So I'm going to check into that. So Whitney, I'll put all those links on the show page, and I'll send the link to you when it is ready. And I hope you share it. And thank you so much for your work. You're just so brilliant. If I haven't told you that lately, your work is brilliant.
I really
you're
appreciate
brilliant.
That.
And I know your energy towards peace and accountability and social justice is just right on. So I'm glad that you've, well, I'm very pleased. I'm not just glad, I'm very pleased that you gave some time to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox this week.
Absolutely. Anytime, Cindy. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Well, you go and have yourself a nice meal.
I will. Thanks.
Promise me.
You're actually the only interview offer I got about this article, so I was glad to talk about it. I wish more people had paid attention.
Oh, yay.
So, yeah. Well, I think what's going on right now, a lot of people aren't paying attention to Venezuela or even Iran or, you know, other things that would normally get a lot more attention these days. It's unfortunate, but
I'm not really paying attention to much.
I just appreciate you you know, inviting me and helping me get the word out, and I'll definitely share the interview once it's online. Thank you.
Great. Well, again, thank you, and hopefully we'll talk soon.
Okay, sounds good. Have a great rest of your day.
Okay, you too.
That's it for this edition of The Soapbox. Isn't Whitney brilliant? I'm just so happy she came on the show. Hopefully we'll be able to talk to her more. I'd like to thank Don DeBar, my engineer. I'd like to thank Whitney for her work, which, as I said, is brilliant. And I'd like to thank you for listening to the show. I think you're brilliant, too. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.